You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio. And we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's and their studio because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. I'm Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from noon to noon 45, although I think today we might be running a little long. Here in the studio today with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez, and call in all of your questions today to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128, because today is a very special day. We have as our call-in guest Nathan Myhrvold, the brain behind the Modernist Cuisine Mega Book Extravaganza that came out, I forget whether it was the beginning of this year or the end of last year. Nathan, you there?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Very good to have you on. So listen, in case there's like a person out there who's been living under a rock or something, this book, basically, Nathan was, were you the head of like GUI design at Microsoft? What was your dealie?
I was chief technology officer.
Chief technology officer. So, you know, like many of the good things from Microsoft came out of Nathan's brain, fair to say, or your team anyway, right?
Yep.
Okay.
That's the idea.
So then decided that didn't necessarily want to be in Microsoft anymore, although apparently you're still buddies with that whole crew, right? Started.
Well, Bill Gates is a great friend of mine, and I still work with him on a variety of things.
Right, like I know.
I've been out of Microsoft now for 11 years, so
right.
It's pretty much their company now, not mine.
Yeah, although, you know, let's be honest, all their good stuff came out before 11 years ago. Boom! Boom! Just kidding. Anyway, so a number of years ago, or many years ago as far as I know, Nathan started traveling the world, going to the finest restaurants in the world, was also an avid cook, and then amassed what, by all accounts, although I've never actually been to the one at your house, is possibly the greatest kitchen in the world. Then, after a while, realized there was no real kind of large-scale encyclopedic book about how to cook using all kinds of new techniques and technologies, and so decided to write a book on the subject, enlisted some of the greatest minds in this field to help, and then 3 or 4 years later, came out with the books that we all know as the Modernist Cuisine book series. Is this accurate or no?
Yeah, you got it, Dave.
Yeah. All right. Wait, Jack. Do we have a call?
Yes.
All right. We already have a call, Nathan. So I'm gonna go right to it. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
Doing well.
My name's Alvin. Actually, I met Nathan at the beginning of the month at dinner at the lab. How are you, Nathan?
Great. How you doing?
Good. Good. I had a question for you guys. I'm getting ready to buy a liquid nitrogen bouillon, and I read the primer on Cooking Issues. I live in an apartment, so I don't know that the 160 Super Ninja bouillon is going to work for me. A lot of chefs have been telling me to get a 10-liter bouillon, but I feel like maybe 20-30 is a better size. Do you guys have any input on that?
What city do you live in? And what city do you live in, and what floor do you live on?
Third floor.
What city?
Houston.
I'm going to defer to Nathan on this. I'd go small. I wouldn't be comfortable having large amounts of nitrogen going up and down stairs. What do you think, Nathan?
You know, as long as you don't spill it, it's okay. You have to make sure you have it in a very well-ventilated room, because if it fell over, you want to make sure that the nitrogen doesn't take too much oxygen, displace too much oxygen from the room. And by the way, it's pronounced Dewar. James Dewar was the guy who invented it. The same Scottish name as Dewar whiskey, although perhaps not the same family.
Interesting.
So, you know, either the 10 or the 20 liter would be fine. The larger the Dewar is, the longer the nitrogen is going to keep.
Right, and
because the heat loss is about the same, but the volume is different.
Right.
So if you have a 20 liter Dewar, you're going to wind up having the nitrogen last a lot longer than a 10 liter.
And the reason I asked you,
but carrying it up and down the stairs is going to be a pain.
Yeah, and the reason I asked you what city you're in is if you're in New York, it's a pain to go get because you have to go to one of the welding shops in the city. It's not advisable to keep it in the passenger area of a car. If you live out in Houston and you have a car, or better yet, even a truck that you can drive out to the place and pick up refills, it's a lot less of a hassle. Wouldn't you agree, Nathan?
Yes, I would. If you drive with liquid nitrogen in the car, which I certainly have been known to do, just have all the windows rolled down.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
the reason for this is the liquid nitrogen, when it boils it into just nitrogen gas, it creates a lot of it. It goes up by a factor of 500, something like that. So you can easily displace all of the volume of the air in your car, and then you pass out, and you could even die. And people have died from spilling a liquid nitrogen Dewar in a small enclosed space. And a car is, by definition, a small enclosed space, and an accident could do it. Even if I had the liquid nitrogen in the trunk, I'd still have the windows rolled down.
Okay.
Although pickup truck is obviously an even better way to go.
Yeah, that's ideal, but just bungee it down properly so it doesn't rattle about.
Got it.
Yep.
Hey, Dave, I noticed when I was looking online at the Dewar, like there's some 10-liter Dewars that say that they're like 30 pounds empty, and then there was like a 30-liter one that said it was 30 pounds full. I imagine the heavier one would be better insulated. Is that correct or not?
I can't
correct?
Imagine a 30-liter Dewar that's 30 pounds full. I think that's probably an error.
Okay.
Yeah.
In general, larger, as Nathan said, the larger they are, the better they are for storage. I'd be wary of buying used Dewars because a lot of times their insulation can be bad. You know, but if you're willing to take the risk and they're good, then they're good. You know, it's just a matter of can you afford to take the risk on a used Dewar? You're rolling the dice.
A Dewar is basically a vacuum bottle. It's like a thermos bottle.
Right.
And they can, if you drop them, for example, you can crack the inside just enough for there to be a vacuum leak, and so you wind up having no insulation value.
Yeah, and you end up finding out overnight when you have no nitrogen when you need it the next day at a demo.
It sounds like that's happened to you, Dave.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, that's another nightmare about renting small-format Dewars from welding shops. They give you the crappiest one they have, and it's usually been beaten about. If you're going to do it on a regular basis, I recommend buying a new one and being nice to it. Here we have another caller on the air. Thank you so much for your question, by the way. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave. Hi, Nathan. This is Michael Natkin from Seattle.
Hey.
Hi. So I was reading the Fat Duck Cookbook lately, and Heston Blumenthal, he talks about using star anise with onions to increase meaty flavors. And he mentions that it is a combination of anisaldehyde and anisidine from the anise, which combines with sulfur and produces some sort of a sulfur heterocyclic. I've tried it. It definitely works. It's beautiful. But I'm sort of curious about the mechanism and whether there are other ways to apply it. So
I have no knowledge of this. Nathan?
Well, I'm going to probably have to pass, too. You know, the flavor chemistry is extremely complicated. And whereas you can find things like what you're describing there, where some of the sulfurous compounds from onions will combine with another flavor to make something meaty, it's hard to generalize. If you took a different spice than star anise, it probably will not work because it won't have the same flavor compounds.
And I know Heston's working with or worked with the guys at Firmenich and a number of other places, and they've, you know, have some wacky stuff. A lot of the chemical arguments for what's going on in cooking in terms of the flavor chemistry, I find them extremely interesting to read, but not necessarily as valuable when you're cooking. McGee is working on a large format book on this kind of subject right now. I mean, it's extremely interesting. That particular one, I even though I have the cookbook, I guess it's obvious I haven't read all the way through it. But I'll investigate that one further and maybe get on the horn with McGee about it, because I think he's investigated that. Any more thoughts on that one, Nathan? Because I hear we have another caller on the air.
Well, we've got, you know, as you say, flavor chemistry is extremely complicated, and you can get some very specific things that will occur with a very specific flavor that you just don't get otherwise. And as an example, many wines have a vanilla flavor in them that comes from oak, because in fact, oak has got compounds very similar to vanillin in vanilla. Now, that's idiosyncratic to oak. It doesn't mean all wood does, or it doesn't mean that you can generalize that to other flavors, unfortunately.
Right, yeah, I made actually a vanilla-like ice cream out of the oak from Scotch after rotovapping. It's pretty good.
And it, how cool!
It's good. Tastes really. You should. I mean, I know you have like. It's easy for you to do. You know, Nathan. Obviously, what I do, I combine the oak with the cream cold so that I can neutralize some of the tannins. But and then either heat or don't do it Sam Mason style with uncooked eggs if you're not worried about the pasteurization. But listen, I promise to look into this anise onion thing. I'm having Nastasha write down the question now, and I promise to look into it more. Okay.
Cool.
You know, we make a thing, Dave, where we rotovap whiskey. To take the alcohol out, which sounds like about the stupidest thing you could possibly do. Take perfectly good Scotch whiskey and remove the alcohol. But my God, the flavors that are present that are masked by the alcohol, because the alcohol is so raw on your tongue and palate that you don't taste the subtlety, it's just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I like both, you know, well, Nathan and I are both big rotovap fans. I like both sides of the still on this one, but next time you do it, just make some, take it down a little further, you know what I mean, so you don't have as much mass, and I don't actually add any milk to it. I just used straight cream because you're adding so much liquid in the form of oak, but it's a damn good ice cream.
Yeah, it sounds great.
All right, Jack, is it true we have another caller? Caller, you are on the air.
Okay. Hello, Dave.
Hello.
This is Joe. I'm calling from South Carolina.
Howdy.
In the introduction to modernist cuisine, I guess Nathan says that he really can't address bread for fear that the book will become too large. I'm curious where bread fits in modernist cuisine in a broader perspective. I'm also curious as to, is there going to be a sequel to modernist cuisine, or did you close down the kitchen and send everybody home?
But Nathan, as long as you're going to answer this, Nathan, I have a very similar question online, so I'll just add those to it, and you can take care of all these at once. This is from Ian Benz, and he's basically saying, would you have done anything differently if you were going to start over? And what's your next project? Any chance for a pastry book? And someone asked the same thing about cocktails, so you might as well hit all of those at once.
Okay, so when people ask me what's next, I always say what we're currently doing is still going on with this book. I mean, I'm right in the middle of an interview or a radio show here. We did a lunch for people yesterday. We did a dinner last week. So the team is all still working very hard, primarily promoting the existing book. And we're doing some experimentation that we could use in the future for a future book, but mostly we're working on the existing book. I think that's going to be true through the first of the year. So in January, we need to make a decision as to what we do next. We didn't cover pastry baking and dessert. It's a world unto itself. We certainly are thinking about doing that as the next book. We might instead, however, do a next smaller book before we do that one, because pastry baking and dessert would be another 2 or 3 year slog for sure. In terms of the status of, cocktails are another thing that people have suggested as something to do, plus there's a million different threads we could pick up, and so we're going to look at all of them. And right now, we really have not made a decision. In terms of the status of bread in modernist cuisine, I'd say pretty much not, in the sense that modernist restaurants only rarely have a bread service or anything like bread or have done something really modernist with bread. I can only think of a couple of examples. Ferran Adria has a dish he calls the air baguette, which looks like a perfectly little ficelle miniature baguette, but in fact is completely hollow inside. And so that's kind of a cool dish. Jose Andres serves that at Bazaar, where they make what they call a Philly cheesesteak out of it by putting a very, very thin slice of beef on top, and they inject a cheese foam inside of it. It's really good. But other than that dish, it's hard for me to think of any other things where a modernist chef has tried to reinvent bread. Dave, can you think of any?
Not really. I mean, it's bread is used as a component by many, many chefs, but they haven't actually reinvented the bread itself. It's just, different.
In your Gastronomica article, you sort of argue that modernism came at different times. It came earlier to paintings than architecture. Has modernism just not reached bread yet?
Well, I think that's certainly a possibility. The pastry and baking have their own sets of traditions, their own things that they follow. Some aspects of pastry and baking already follow the same approach that modernist chefs take. So modern chefs are always weighing things out exactly, and we always have a pantry full of little white powders, and so do pastry chefs. You don't add baking soda by taste or by guess and by gosh. You have to weigh it out if you want a consistent result. I've not seen anything that I really could call modernist baking or bread. Modernist pastry, yes. Pastry chefs have been at the forefront of modernist cuisine. At many modernist restaurants, the pastry chef is actually out in front of the savory guys. At many other restaurants that are still traditional or nouvelle in character, it's the pastry chef that's dragging the rest of the kitchen into the 20th century or 21st century.
Sort of like Johnny Azzini at Jean Georges, or any one of those Michael
Lascanus. Or Michael Lascanus of
Le
Bernardin, are two great examples.
Yeah. Let me further on these questions, because we have, this is again from Ian Benz writing in on similar questions. Knowing what you know now about the whole process of realizing the book, would you have done anything differently if you were to start it over?
Well, we learned lots of things while doing the book. And so some of those things you'd like to have learned a little bit sooner, of course. But really, there wasn't... I was pretty happy with the whole process. There's very little I would do differently. I originally thought I was going to write a big book, and I thought big meant 600 pages, and then 800, and then 1,000. And if we'd owned up front and knew it was going to be 2,400 from the start, maybe I wouldn't have started the thing. It would have seemed too daunting.
Right.
But I don't really have a lot of regrets on it, no.
Well, as he also said, he hopes you're proud of the accomplishment because he finds it really incredible, as do I think all of us. But he makes a point here, Ian, when he's asking the questions. He says he's sure you could not be completely satisfied, especially in this age where every week a new technique or discovery seems to come to light that changes one's ideas of what can be done. But I think it's actually kind of the opposite because, I mean, the most challenging thing it had to have been for this book is, because new things are happening, is to make a statement that's going to survive the test of time and yet still deal with newness. And I think that's kind of that's the whole thing behind the book. That's the whole kind of interesting thing about it, right?
Yes, and it was a challenge as we were finishing the book up to send to the printer. Every day I'd think of one other thing we hadn't included, and I'd call Max up and say, "Oh my God, we don't have a recipe for skyr." Yeah, we have a section in the book that covers various fresh cheeses,
right,
and fermented milk products. So we had yogurt. We didn't have skyr, by God. And skyr is sort of halfway between farmer's cheese and yogurt. It's got rennet in it like farmer's cheese is, but also is fermented like yogurt. Now, could we have shipped the book without skyr? Yes, but we did sneak it in the 11th hour. And, of course, since we finally shipped the book off, more things like that have piled up.
Right. I mean, well, the lucky thing is, food is such a huge subject, that there.
Yeah, you couldn't ever cover all of it.
Right.
The other day I was someplace and I had some pozole, And I hit myself in the forehead. My God, we never covered hominy.
At all?
And the whole process of using lime to treat corn, which is intrinsic to not only hominy, but to making the masa harina for making tortillas. Like, God damn it, how did I forget hominy? But, you know, I think hopefully the world will forgive me for forgetting hominy.
Well, I say there's plenty there's plenty of other stuff. And, you know, honestly, the thing is for the rest of us that, you know, not writing, you know, books like this, but do write in this field, it's kind of lucky that it's such a huge subject that, you know, you guys can't tackle all of it, or what would we do for a living?
Well, you know, Dave, while we were working on the book, we followed your blog very carefully to make sure that we had covered all the things you had put out there. Not always in as much detail, because we decided not to cover cocktails, for example, which is a big part of your blog and your cuisine. But we tried to stay on top of new developments, but we knew for a fact new stuff would happen the minute we were done. And that's okay, because what we wanted to do was create enough of a foundation and a base that we communicate it to everyone, and if you waited for it to be complete, you'd never do it at all.
Right, exactly. We have one more caller, and then we're going to take a break. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Andrew from Minneapolis.
Howdy.
And I had a question for Nathan. I'm just wondering what's one of the biggest things you and your team learned in making the book about food and cooking that really made you stand back and say, wow, like, this is a crazy thing that's happening. Or maybe one of the things that you felt like you learned about food and that your research team learned, that you felt like you were the first ones learning this and you were the first ones kind of making this almost in a pioneering aspect of what you were fiddling with.
Okay, well, I'll quickly touch on a couple of those. I mean, one which is very controversial with traditional chefs is that confit is a fraud. By confit, I mean the traditional cooking technique where you cook meat in fat or oil at low temperature for a long period of time.
Yep.
Duck confit is, of course, the classic example. Mm. And while working on the meat chapter, I was trying to figure out how cooking the meat in oil or fat could possibly change the meat. And I decided it couldn't possibly. The molecules are too large for them to penetrate the meat. But every traditional chef, particularly French chef, believes that there's something unique that happens. So we did a bunch of blind taste tests where we took both duck leg confit. We also did pork shoulder. And we tried it steamed, sous vide, and traditional methods. And in a blind taste test, we couldn't tell the difference.
Oh, wow.
And when I tell some traditional French chefs this, they get almost angry. So one guy says, I do not agree. And I said, this isn't about agreeing. Tell me you've tried the blind taste test and you can taste the difference, and I'll believe you. But if you haven't tried, And that's sort of an interesting question of attitude there. If, in fact, you try the experiment and you can't tell the difference in a blind test, that tells you something very profound. But a lot of folks think that there's an ideology of food that you should believe this stuff without testing it like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one example. We also learned what causes the stall in barbecue. This is when you cook a brisket or a big piece of meat. The people have noticed for many years that the temperature will rise for a while, then it will flatten out and stall and not increase for many hours before it increases again. And there's tons of theories on the internet about why that occurs, and we finally found out why. And turns out the reason is that the meat is drying out, and the temperature is held down by the fact that the evaporation takes a tremendous amount of energy. The thing that's ironic about it is that some people think the cure for the stall is to slather more sauce onto their meat, which of course only makes it wetter, which only keeps the stall going longer.
Yeah.
So there's a couple examples.
Although combining those two, right? I mean, traditional confit is a good technique for producing that texture on a duck if you don't have access to vacuum bags or controlled atmosphere cooking.
Yeah, or a steam oven. That's right. What we found in those blind taste tests, actually, is that what mattered was the temperature and the time. So if you cooked it at different temperatures, we could totally tell the difference.
Right.
You'd have to decide which one you preferred, but there clearly was a difference if you cooked the duck at say 60C or 65C or 80C. You could totally tell those. But we couldn't tell whether we steamed it in a combi oven or a CVAP or we or cooked it sous vide or traditional. And so you're right, Dave, that the original point of confit was really a sort of approach to sous vide where you could cook it at a low temperature for a long period of time and exclude air from it so that for storage. And that's why there's a similarity.
All righty, and with that, we will go to our first commercial break. Baby beside me at the wheel, I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile. My curiosity running wild, cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go. Riding along in my automobile, I was anxious to tell her the way I feel. So I told her softly and sincere, and she leaned and whispered in my ear, cuddling more and driving slow with no particular place to go. No particular place to go. So we parked way out in the Kokomo. The night was young and the moon was gold, so we both decided to take a stroll. Can you imagine the way I felt? I couldn't unfasten a safety belt, riding along in my calaboose, still trying to get her belt loose. All the way home I held a grudge for the safety belt that wouldn't budge. Cruising and playing the radio with no particular place to go. All right, welcome back to Cooking Issues. First time we've had Chuck Berry. Call in your questions too for Nathan Myhrvold, 2-718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Next caller gets a Modernist Cuisine signed apron, signed by Nathan, Chris, and Max. We got who's on that apron? Do you know Nathan?
I think it's all three of us.
All right, nice. So let me follow up again. You mentioned a little bit about cocktails, but Kevin Liu wrote in and said he has a question for you. Cocktail science is a branch of Modernist Cuisine that you didn't touch upon. We've talked about that. Do you consider mixology cooking? And how far do you think chefs and bartenders should be able to take their creations? And do you have any insights about cocktail science that you can share with us?
So I'm not an expert on modernist cocktails. I certainly have had them, and many of them draw on the same kinds of science and principles. But I wouldn't call myself an expert. Dave, you're much more into it than I am. Yes, I do consider it cooking in a variety of senses, but it's not always practiced that way. You know, that most cocktails are mixed by a bartender, most traditional cocktails, and they generally don't have the manpower to do anything very elaborate. They're also the server. And you typically have a fairly small number of bartenders with a fairly large number of people. You couldn't actually serve dinner if you had the same number of chefs as bartenders to customers. The ratio wouldn't work.
Right.
And that's because most drinks are, of course, simple. You splash some scotch and water into a glass. That isn't cooking. But real modernist mixology that makes the complicated drinks, I definitely think it qualifies.
Right, and in fact, I mean, that's one of the reasons I became interested in it, was because I thought there was a niche that wasn't being adequately explored, you know, and that's kind of one of the reasons I got into. Plus, I like cocktails, you know, so it's kind of a win-win situation. On a similar note, I'll just hit it real quick while we're waiting for the next caller to come in. Colin, longtime listener, writer in, says that cocktail geeks are loving the Ramos Gin Fizz. Bartenders are hating their guts for repopularizing a drink involving a 12-minute shake, although they don't really take 12 minutes to shake, and by the way, bartenders also, I was last at the Tales of the Cocktail in July, and bartenders were ordering this drink by the bushel. And basically, Colin wants to know, is there a better way? So Ramos Gin Fizz is actually a drink that I don't much like. It's got like eggs, dairy, gin, orange flower water, and some other stuff, and you shake the heck out of it, and it gets this creamy, to my taste, under-alcoholic kind of thing that apparently is becoming more popular. But I'm not a huge orange flower water person. Anyway, the secret, Colin, is to shake the ingredients dry without ice first to start the emulsification process. That's the old school way to do it. If I were you, I would invest in some in a mix of xanthan and gum arabic and keep it at your bar at all times. TIC Gums makes a good one called Saladizer 301 or 310 or something like that. And it's basically, you can use it to make butter syrups or oil syrups, or you can use it to stabilize Aramos or anything else. And it's just handy stuff to have around. The gum arabic acts as an emulsifier and a bodying agent, and the xanthan acts as a stabilizer. So I would get a hold of that. Any have any other ideas on that, Nathan?
You made the point I would make. I mean, the other thing is make sure that you've got a good mixer or homogenizer for making the emulsion.
Yeah, well, Nathan has a bunch of nifty different homogenizers. You know, he has the Rotor Stator, which actually is becoming more popular now. Tony, our buddy Tony C, Tony Canoliaro from England's got one in his bar, and, you know, we have one, you have one, a bunch of people have them now. But Nathan is the only person that I know who also has a high-pressure homogenizer. He can do some serious business with that, right?
Yep. Oh, it's fantastic. It it uses very, very high pressure, 30,000 pounds per square inch, to create incredibly fine emulsions. So a blender can typically get you down around 10 to 15 micron droplet size. And with a rotor stator, you can probably get it down to 5 microns. With the high pressure, we can routinely get it down to 1 micron.
Wow. And by the way, when Nathan says blender, he doesn't mean a crappy blender that you buy at Costco. He means a VitaPrep.
Yeah, a VitaPrep or BlendTec or one of the other really high-end ones. There really is a difference. But a rotor stator homogenizer, which is a piece of laboratory equipment, does a vastly better job even than a VitaPrep.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
For most things.
I mean, the interesting thing about it is... once you get below about, first of all, you know, the particle size that you can get out of a blender has to do with a number of things: how efficiently the blades can get to the particles, how much mixing there is, et cetera, how the blade size in relation to the tank size, all that. But at the end, you're limited by the kind of the tip speed, how fast the tip is hitting your products. And in a rotor stator, there's a rotor that's rotating and a stator that's standing still. So in effect, it's the equivalent of, in one, you're just slicing a knife through the air, and the other, you put someone's head against the wall and then slice the knife through it. It's that kind of an addition of energy that you're talking about, which is the reason that it can get to such smaller sizes, right, Nathan? Would you agree with it, with that description?
Yes, absolutely. That's the whole. What you're trying to do is create shear in the liquid, and a ordinary blender is trying to slice the blade faster than the fluid is moving. And the amount of shear depends basically on the relative speed of the liquid and the blade. But, of course, the liquid is moving and it can push out of the way, whereas a rotor stator just forces all of the liquid in a very, very fine gap, a hundredth of an inch sort of a gap, where one side is stationary, the other side is at super high speed, and it creates just vastly more shear.
Right. Now, the other interesting thing about blending is that your tongue... Okay, in terms of texture, your tongue can't really perceive texture below about 20 microns, thereabout, that order of magnitude, in that range, 20 microns in size, which is why liquid nitrogen ice cream isn't perceptibly better than ice cream made in a high-end commercial ice cream machine, even though its ice crystals are theoretically smaller, right? Because your tongue can't perceive it. So what's interesting is that the rotor stator has two possibilities for use. One, you need a small particle size, like, for instance, like I did this thing with oysters, and you might choke out the oysters if you have large particles. Two, you want a very stable emulsion, so you want the smaller things. If you're making milks, which is a big section in other milks, like duck fat milk, which is a big section in modernist cuisine, or but there apparently, and I haven't done the studies myself, but Nathan I'm sure has, there are taste perception differences that depend upon the size of the droplets below your threshold for perceiving texture. Is that true, you'd say, or no?
Yeah, I think that is true. The other one, though, is the is how it looks, the optical properties.
Right, try and tell that.
We have a photo in the book where we took a green liquid, a parsley juice, actually, and then emulsified it with oil in a bunch of different ways. And the smaller the droplets, the whiter it gets. When put through the high-pressure homogenizer, you wind up with something which is it's like a tiny amount of tint to cream. Whereas if you whisk it by hand, you can still make an emulsion, but the emulsion is very, very green. And the reason is that the droplets of oil in the emulsion, they scatter light. The smaller you make them, the more of them there are. And so the more scattering you get, and so the more whiteness you get.
Right. How up are you on pickle technology, Nathan?
Fair amount. We have quite a few pickles in the book.
All right, let's take this question from Red then. While I've made good half sours at home with salt and water, so we're talking a fermented pickle, not a quick pickle, and small amounts of alum. I don't use alum, but I mean, I have it, but I don't use it. They are not what I would find in New York. Would adding calcium hydroxide to a half sour brine keep them bright green and help them prevent them from getting soft? I've done some stuff with this. I would say I wouldn't add it to the brine. We're talking about pickling lime. I would soak them before you brine them. That will stop them getting soft, but I don't think it's going to keep them bright green. Did you ever do any research with cooking in copper to keep things green or any of these things with pickles?
No, we didn't.
Because it's toxic.
We didn't cover pickles that extensively.
Well, I think it's because it's toxic. That's why none of us do it, right? Theoretically toxic.
Well, that would be one of the reasons, yes. You know, obviously, copper does oxidize green, but and as a result, there are blue dyes that are copper-based and so forth, but they're toxic, and so I wouldn't do that.
Right, I mean, in the research I was doing this morning, because it came in this morning, you know, they used to boil, apparently, because, you know, you can, not boil, but you can high-temp simmer for a brief period of time below the softening point, and apparently that was another way to increase firmness. Although, I don't know why, I guess to get the pectin methyl esterase to help reinforce the structures below the point at which they, pectin, below the point at which you break it down, I don't know. But apparently they used to do it in copper, and that would lead to a bright green color because you're replacing the ion and the chlorophyll with copper, which is stable and bright green. But I wouldn't do it. I don't think the green's that important. Do you?
I agree.
Yeah. I mean, in other words, I don't think it's as big a flavor. So preventing oxidation or changes in color in something like an apple, I think, is vital because the flavor is also changing at the same time as a direct result of what's going on. But I don't think the same is true with pickles and them turning a shade of green. I don't think it's going to affect the flavor. It's just not my feeling.
Well, I think you're probably right. And of course, if you do want to dye something green, there's safe ways to dye green. And I would rather use a safe food coloring than some copper thing I'm leaching out of my pots.
Right, right. And on safety, we have a question, and he has a couple questions here. We'll take this one right now. Mike calls in with plastic wrap, and he says, I can't recall us discussing plastic wrap on the air before. I mean, it's something I've dealt with a little bit on the blog, but what are the heat effects on plastic wrap, specifically the consumer plastic wraps I might find in the supermarket, or maybe the food service ones I can find at a restaurant supply? What's the safe temperature range to use in poaching and immersion baths in a galantine, for instance, and what should they worry about? What's going to leach into the food? I would say actually a home one is probably going to end up, they're crappier because they're smaller and they're a pain to deal with, but and most food service wrap now is polyethylene like the home ones, but I would stay away from PVC wraps, obviously. But I mean,
you do find PVC wraps in restaurant supply places. You find it at Costco in big any of the really big containers of the plastic wrap are usually PVC. At least often there, you got to check. And PVC is considered okay if the stuff isn't hot. But I'd just rather not have it in the kitchen because I don't want to have to remember which plastic wrap should be hot and which plastic wrap should not be hot.
Are they labeled? I can't remember. I'm trying to remember in my head looking for the label on a box.
If you read the box, I've always seen it labeled.
Right.
It'll say PVC or polyvinyl chloride somewhere if it's a PVC side. If it's not always true that the polyethylene ones have a thing if they have a proprietary thing. I'm not sure that Saran Wrap says it's polyethylene because it's this proprietary brand name.
Right.
It is polyethylene. It is safe.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing I find with plastic wraps is, I mean, polyethylene is great because it's supposed to not have any plasticizers that are going to leach into your food. However, they are made with solvents, and if they're not allowed to flash off properly when they're coming off the rolls at the mill, they can have some solvent aroma left to them. It's miraculous to me if you wad up plastic wrap and smell it, how many of them have a smell. Have you noticed that too, Nathan? I mean, it's just like, you know, at the school it happens a lot because we have a bunch of different plastic wraps lying around and you can just kind of run around the school and smell them. But, you know, I think also the PVC ones tend to, look, the biggest problem is fat-related things. If there's anything in the plastic, solvents or whatnot, they tend to be more lipophilic than hydrophilic. And so this is why if you have a bad plastic wrap and you go to a cheese shop and they wrap cheese in it, the cheese picks up these horrible aromas from the plastic that basically never come out, and the cheese is ruined from an organoleptic standpoint, not necessarily from a safety standpoint. That said, I use polyethylene all the time, all the way up to, I mean, I don't do much protein cooking above 62 or so, except for confit, which I like at traditional temperatures. What about you, Nathan? Do you have any upper limits that you'd take the polyethylene to?
You know, normally the upper limit is sort of enforced on you by the fact that stuff gets really soft.
Right.
Real sous vide bags are usually multi-layered. They usually have nylon as one of their layers, and they're good for much higher temperatures. And they're also safe and tested at much higher temperatures. So something like a Ziploc bag or a plastic wrap, I tend to use at 60 C or below, and there just isn't a whole lot of reason for stuff you'd cook hotter to use that stuff because there's better ways to do it.
Right. I mean, we do chicken galantines at like 64 in plastic wrap and they're fine. You know, but that's basically the highest that will we'll go up. And also, for Mike, you want to take a non-technical question? You want to take a dinner etiquette and marriage question we have from Mike that maybe we can both weigh in on here?
Sure.
Okay, so Mike's question is on dinner parties. When having guests over for a dinner party, 8 people or less, would you serve food with a plated presentation, family style at the table, or buffet? Here's his background. His wife and he are trying to entertain smaller groups versus going out to large gatherings because of better quality conversation, close friends, etc. And Mike loves to cook, so he takes this on happily. His wife is a wonderful person, he says. He's making this thing. His wife is wonderful. He's not saying anything negative about her, but a fairly picky eater. Mainly texture over taste, but that's for another day. She never makes a fuss over it and has never gone hungry when we're out. But he's worried about if he plates his food, he wants to do plated food because he wants to challenge himself and because he thinks he'd like to think through the menu for the night. And he thinks he likes to think about the way everything's going to show up on a plate. She doesn't want it plated. She wants it family style because it's going to allow her to discreetly choose what to eat and what not to eat and also to control portion size and not feel left out, not feel like she's being served something and not eating it and feel bad. So what do you think? Help Mike out here.
Well, It's pretty hard to recommend to anyone that they do something that will upset their spouse. That's probably not a good idea just in general in life. The reason to do plated dishes is because it gives the chef control. It allows you to do fancier, more interesting things in general. Almost anything you plate up, you could put onto a platter, but then it's harder to transfer and it doesn't look as nice. That said, the food is going to be, apart from a very few exceptions, I think the food's going to be fine either way. So I would say try to strike a compromise with your wife and find some, you also can do family style for some things and not for others. You know, you can have your entree, some restaurants do that, you know, the steakhouse, typically the steak is individual, and the side dishes are all done family style.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's excellent advice. Pick some stuff that you know is a slam dunk for your wife, stuff that you know she likes, and work only with those things on the plated stuff, and have them come out early in the meal when she's not full yet, and then she can scale back her portion sizes later in the meal when you go family style, right? Wouldn't that make sense?
Makes sense to me.
I mean, for me, I get viciously, viciously angry if I plate something. And I'm not just talking plated, like, I'm talking sandwiches. Anytime you construct a food and then you watch someone pick it apart in front of you, I get viciously angry. Even, and I shouldn't say this on the air because people do it all the time, but like, even when chefs do it, when I see someone do it to someone else's food, I'm like, look, at least taste it the way that they presented it, because that's the way it was intended,
yeah.
And then pick it apart. I mean, a sandwich doesn't taste the same if it's horribly mangled and then rearranged. It's not intended to be eaten that way. Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
Doesn't that make you kind of irritated sometimes, Nathan? I mean, if you actually hate something or you're allergic, fine. You know what I mean? But you're still not. Better to tell the kitchen that beforehand, right? This way they can make adjustments to the sandwich or to the plate, such that it's still something that they're proud of. Here's my problem with it. My problem with it is you mangle somebody's plating or somebody's dish, right? And then you judge them based on your mangled version of their dish without giving them the opportunity to make the dish such that you would like it given your issues with the food, right? I mean, does that make sense or no?
Yeah, I think it does make sense. There's a lot to be said for having the chef be allowed to make it the best possible way. Anyone who is cooking for other people wants to please those people. And so it is always a little disappointing if you're not given that opportunity. Now, to be fair, there are some people who, for whatever reason, view it oppositely, and they say, oh, I don't want to bother the chef by telling him that I don't like, pickles on my sandwich or some other thing, that they feel that's being too picky, and so they don't say it up front, and then they try to pick it out afterwards. But I agree. In general, you should be up front with what your requests are. Obviously, if someone's allergic to something, that's a totally different issue. Although, if you're really allergic to it, it's too late to pick it up at the time. You know?
Yeah. But
if you have a nut allergy, picking the peanuts out of your Kung Pao chicken is too late. You're screwed.
Let's take. Okay, Nastasha's telling me I have to take a break, but I'll say this. Pickles is a very good example. If I put pickles on something, it's not just because I like pickles, but probably because that dish desperately needs the acidity from the pickle. Do you know what I mean? So you remove that pickle, and now you've unbalanced the whole thing. Then if you don't enjoy it, I feel bad. That's what it is. Basically, if you don't enjoy it, I feel bad. That's what it comes down to.
Yep.
All right, listen, the next caller, and we're going to go take one more break. The next caller is going to get that apron. 718-497-2128. 718-497-2128. Cooking Issues. What was that song anyway? What is it? The Avalanche? Not The Avalanche. I don't know that one. This is the first time we've had a song. I have no idea what it is. Anyway, welcome back to Cooking Issues. Call your questions to 718-497-2128. Your questions from Nathan Myhrvold at 718-497-2128. Well, we have an interesting one in from Josh in Antigua. Says, hello. He's been cooking Dave Chang's 5-minute, 10-second eggs and eating them with everything lately. He notices sometimes it's harder to peel them without obliterating the white of the egg. Is this due to something in my procedure? I bring the eggs to room temperature before I boil them, let them sit in warm water. After boiling for 4 minutes and 50 seconds, he thinks 5:10 is too set. He places the eggs in an ice bath until they're cool enough to handle. After wrapping a spoon against the shell until it's shattered into small pieces, he then peels the eggs in the ice bath. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. Sometimes the eggs come off with... Sorry, I didn't mean blah, 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 Josh. You know what I'm saying. Sometimes it comes off with no problem. Other times it rips the egg apart. Please explain what's going on. I have my feelings on it. Nathan, do you have any feelings on that one?
Well, the texture of egg is very critically dependent on the temperature at which it's cooked. And so the first question I would have is, how consistent is it? If you're boiling and timing it exactly, that's probably okay, unless you're varying the number of eggs or the size of the pot or how crowded they are, because that can make a difference. If the water on the egg is a little cooler because you put too many eggs in, you're going to wind up with it less cooked, which means it's much easier to rip it. The other possibility is that it has been established that the age of the egg makes a difference, that very fresh versus older eggs will have a different texture.
Right.
So that could be it.
I think that's exactly what's going on. I mean, Chang's, I think, argument there is rapidly boiling large pots and, you know, a quantity of eggs that's not going to perceptibly lower the temperature of the water, that it's going to be able to recover quickly enough that it's not going to make that much of a difference. He always uses the same type, same size rather, of egg, and always starting at the same initial temperature, which, as Nathan said, should prove fairly accurate. There are some studies that show that eggs boiled quickly at a high temperature rather than ramped up from cold are easier to shell than ones that are ramped up from cold and then shelled. Nathan and I both know that the exact opposite is true of low temperature eggs, ones that are cooked in the 62, 63, 64 Celsius range, because there the thin white just never sets up and it acts as a release agent. And there's nothing easier in the world than breaking out an egg that's been cooked at 62 degrees Celsius.
Yep.
I mean, the other thing is, as eggs age, the pH rises. The egg white becomes more alkaline. And as it becomes more alkaline, and this is according to Egg Science and Technology by William Stadelman, and others, as the pH rises, the eggs become easier to shell because the proteins in the thin white don't adhere as strongly to the membrane. And this is a big deal in egg processing technology because people produce for a living shelled eggs, and the value goes down dramatically. So people try to figure out a way to not have to store eggs, boil them quickly, and then rip the shells off of them. And so what they do is they actually alkalize the eggs. They store them above a sodium hydroxide bath, not in it, but above it, and that increases the pH more rapidly than aging. And McGee actually recommends putting a pinch of baking soda into your water, although I've never tried it, to try and alkalize it more and make them easier to shell. And another interesting reason to try and take a fresh egg and alkalize it so that it can peel easily is because even though it becomes easier to peel, the taste of eggs in the panels I've read on in these technical studies, the taste of egg does deteriorate over time, even though the peelability goes up. Anyway, we have a caller on the air.
Here's one other little tip I'll say. If you really want to make it easier to peel your eggs, run a blowtorch very lightly over the egg before peeling. It helps degrade the shell, and it's much easier. It also works to roll the egg in liquid nitrogen very briefly before peeling it.
That's hilarious.
So extreme hot or extreme cold, both will make the shell more brittle.
You heard it here first, unless you own Modernist Cuisine. All right, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Matt. I'm calling from Chicago.
Howdy.
Dave, I talked to you a while ago about nitrous-infusing honey, and it didn't really work out, but that's a whole other story. Lately, I've been playing around with a little bit of baking soda and Chardonnay
right.
to make it effervescent.
Right.
I did like a powdered sugar and baking soda rim, and I was wondering if you guys could give me some suggestions on doing a sorbet that has, say, something on top of it, so when you eat the sorbet and it melts, it becomes effervescent in your mouth.
Oh, by the way, you won the apron, so don't hang up when you're done. We'll get you back on the air, and we'll figure out how to mail the thing to you, because you were the next caller. So,
awesome. Thank you very much.
Well, thank Nathan. He donated it to the show for you to have. But, Nathan, you have any ideas? I wouldn't use baking soda, by the way. I mean, you need an acid plus a base. I wouldn't use but anyway, Nathan, go ahead.
Well, you know, the problem with having an acid-base reaction to make it effervescent is you're going to get some taste out of it.
Right.
Which, in some contexts, that's okay. You know, baking powder biscuits have a taste that is characteristic that way. Unclear whether it's going to be okay in your Chardonnay. I mean, but that's sort of a personal preference. The only other way to make something effervescent is to put in something like Pop Rocks that already is effervescent itself, and it's sort of stored effervescent.
Right, and
okay.
The Pop Rocks is definitely, I think, a better way to go, and you can buy unflavored Pop Rocks. Although, to be fair, Nathan, Pop Rocks isn't the same feeling as like effervescence in a drink. Hey, why don't we'll leave him on the air because we need him to get the thing, but we'll tone down his
thing. That is the direct way.
Yeah.
So take your Chardonnay and put it in a seltzer bottle and infuse it with CO2.
Yeah, much better.
Right? The reason that soft drinks and champagne are effervescent is that they have carbon dioxide gas dissolved in it. And carbon dioxide happens to be a gas that will very readily dissolve in a cold liquid. A seltzer bottle is exactly how you do that. So I would say, look, if you really want to have effervescent Chardonnay to make sort of a faux champagne, carbonate it directly.
Yeah.
And
okay.
The seltzer bottle is the simplest way. There are some other approaches you can do. If you put a tiny bit of dry ice into the bottle and seal it up, that'll also work. You just got to be careful you don't blow your bottle up.
Yes.
Okay.
I would Google image dry ice soda bottle to see people's eyes when they don't do it properly, because the bottle will blow.
My question was, I'm trying to do it for a dessert where it's a sorbet, like it's a Chardonnay sorbet, and maybe there's some kind of chemical on top that as it melts in the mouth or as you put it together, it's almost effervescent in your mouth, as if the reaction is going on in your mouth. And you think maybe the Pop Rocks is best for that?
There's two ways you could do that. You could put Pop Rocks powder on top. That would work, but it will have its own sort of texture and taste characteristics. You know, I've not tried this, but if you made your sorbet, you ought to be able to carbonate it.
It's tough because the carbonation only works in the liquid phase, so it's a question of how much liquid
That's
phase.
That's why you have to spin it first. You can't freeze it, but if you took it and you made a sorbet in a sorbet machine or a Paco Jet or something else, so it's in its state that's semi-liquid, I bet you will get some CO2 in there.
I mean,
I
pressurized a tailor once, and besides spraying ice cream base all over the kitchen, I wasn't able to get as much of an effect as I wanted. Sam Mason was working on this for a while. I'm sure. Look, it's possible, but the carbonation is only going to be present in the liquid phase. So you're going to have to. The soupier your sorbet is, the better the effect of the carbonation is going to be. I mean, I think you might want to go with the Pop Rocks. Don't you think that's the easiest way?
Pop Rocks may well work better. There's a guy, someone on the internet who has a site on dry ice cream, where instead of making ice cream with liquid nitrogen, which is something Dave and I have been known to do, he puts powdered dry ice into it, and then puts it into lets it sit. Well, the interesting thing is the carbon dioxide does not get absorbed very much into the ice cream base. A little bit it does. But it makes a texture that looks almost exactly like white bread.
Because I've done that before with dry ice pellets.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the way to make... Now, that's not quite the same thing as you're describing.
Right. No. But I'm just saying, I've made an ice cream before with the base and dry ice pellets.
Okay, cool.
I mean, I once made it by mistake, like many, many years ago, chilled a base with dry ice because I found a soft serve machine on the street and the chilling thing didn't work. And I chilled down the base with dry ice and then froze it soft serve, and it was... It was horrible. First of all, it was the first time in my life, many, many years ago, that I had made a large amount of base at once in a pot by hand, and I curdled the eggs at the bottom, and so it tasted like scrambled egg soda ice cream, but not in a good kind of Heston Blumenthal way, kind of in a really crappy, I messed up the ice cream way.
Hello, Dave?
Yep.
Okay. Hey, listen, I appreciate your information, and it's been great. It's getting kind of loud where I'm at, sorry.
All right.
But I just wanted to tell you, real quickly, I think the conversation with Steve Miller was that the old record executive sent a younger guy in there, and the younger guy told him he had to have a hit record, so Steve Miller kicked back and said, well, how about this? Abracadabra, I'm going to reach out and grab you.
For real? All right, Nathan, what we're talking about here is Steve Miller's worst song is clearly Abracadabra. I don't know whether, Nathan, whether you're a Steve Miller fan or not, but the worst song Steve Miller ever came up with by far, Abracadabra. All right, I'm told that we have one more caller on the air. True? We lost him. If they come back, they come back. Okay, we had a question in from Nedward via Eater. Nathan noted that someone spotted you on an airplane reading the Modernist Cuisine PDFs. Do you plan on selling the PDFs to poor cooks who can't buy the book?
You know, I really don't think anyone spotted me on an airplane doing that.
Hey, look, this is not me. This is coming in via the internets.
Okay, it's true, but just let me say, I have not been in that situation. I can promise you that.
So you're not denying that the PDFs exist.
Obviously, you make PDFs in order to print the book. You know, PDFs are a key part of the whole printing process. That's how the book gets sent over to the printer in China, is as PDFs. So, of course, we have PDFs of the book. And we have had, there was a period where we had some reviewers that needed to see the book. We didn't have physical books, so we had a password-protected website where reviewers could go read the PDFs. And the result was kind of interesting. Most people found that it was better than nothing, but only a little bit better than nothing, and that the usability was not very good. I think if we really wanted to make a online or interactive or iPad version of the book, we'd have to do something a lot more extensive than simply put the PDFs up there, because navigating around those huge photos, navigating around the rest of the book is just too hard.
Right. All right. Let's take...
So someday I would like to have an interactive version of the book. You know, we made a decision 2 years before release as to what platform we would target first, and we chose paper books because there was no iPad. And Kindle didn't do color, and still doesn't. So you really couldn't have something that would really show off what we were trying to do. At some point in the future, we will probably make an interactive version, but it's a lot of work.
Well, to get the quality, to get the interaction the same, you mean to get the quality what you want.
Well,
I mean, you could easily do an online version.
Do you want to have video? Do you want to have animations? Do you want to have good navigation? All of those things take some software development effort, or they take a whole bunch more effort in shooting a video. It's not easy to do.
Right. I guess the point is, you could do it now, but you can't do it right, and you don't want to do it wrong.
Exactly. You said it better than I did.
Yeah. Apparently, that caller that got dropped is back on the air. Let's take one last call. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello. This is Daniel from San Jose, California.
Howdy.
I had a question about acidic marinades. In the book Modernist Cuisine, there's a section on acidic marinades in meat, and the section talks about how acidic marinades can actually tenderize meats and improve their moisture-holding capacities. I was interested in how you guys came to this conclusion, because I've noticed that there are others like Harold Mickey who believe that acidic marinades only denature protein on the surface of meats.
Take it away, Nathan.
Well, I think there's two issues going on here. First of all, marinades only penetrate a certain distance. That's just a fact. And any marinade is only going to work on the surface if you don't either give it enough time to go in, or you don't do something like injection or tumbling or other things to speed it up. Now, an acidic marinade, if it's, there are many cookbooks that will have an acidic marinade where you put the meat in for a very short period of time, 20 minutes or something like that. That is just a surface flavoring. And that's fine if that's the surface flavor you want to get. You just shouldn't think you're going to change the interior of a piece of meat in a 10 or 20 minute period. It just isn't going to happen. It takes too long for the diffusion time. But an acidic marinade certainly will denature proteins all the way through the meat if you get the marinade all the way through the meat. And either by waiting long enough or by using injection or tumbling or all of the above, you certainly can get that to happen. And the similar things, of course, occur with an alkaline marinade. In either case, what you're trying to do is take the meat proteins into a regime where they're not normally present in meat. So you either make it much more acidic or much more alkaline, and either one causes some of the proteins to break down. And depending on the context, that could be desirable. But I promise you it'll work all the way through if you inject it or tumble it, or simply wait long enough or have your meat be thin enough.
All right, thank you.
Well, there you have it. And I would like to, I'm gonna answer, a guy named Josh writes in and asks where he can get high-proof liquor in England because he wants to do like infusions and wants to know if you really need the high-proof liquor. Answer, Josh, yes. You can't buy Everclear in England, though. They don't sell it. Look for Spiritus Vodka out of Poland at the Whiskey Exchange, or look for Stroh Rum from Austria, the original 80%. That'll float your infusion boat. I have many, many thanks. Thank you, Nathan, for spending this last hour with us. I think people really enjoyed it. Hopefully, you'll come on again sometime. Modernist Cuisine, the greatest series of cookbooks ever written. Cooking Issues.
Thank you.
Vicious, vicious vodka. Oh, you did that. Got me on this corner, and I don't know where I'm at. Supposed to meet my baby. I'm 20 minutes late. You got my head all twisted. I just can't get it straight. Vicious, vicious vodka. Oh, you dirty rat. Got me on this corner, and I don't know where I'm at. I had a chance to swap you for a little.
Every spring at the end of kidding season, goat dairies across the country are faced with the question of what to do with their male bucklings. Because on a dairy farm, there's no role for a male. Often the most economical thing for these farmers to do is to cull the animals at birth or ship them off to the commodity market. Heritage Foods USA is embarking on a new project, No Goat Left Behind, looking to step in and fill this niche by creating a marketplace for these male bucklings. Visit us at www.heritagefoodsusa.com to learn more and to reserve your goat this coming October.
New York Night Train, Summer Soul Shindig, Rockaway Beach Party, featuring the 45 RPM soul magic of DJ Jonathan Tobin. Saturday, August 20th, 6 to 9 at Ripper's, Boardwalk 86. Free party!